Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today is a Welsh novelist, poet and journalist. He first made his name with his novel Submarine, which was made into a film. He graduated from the University of East Anglia's Creative Writing MA, where he was awarded the Curtis Brown Prize. His second book is Wild Abandon, and it won the Society of Authors Encore Award. Jo Dunthorne, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you.
I describe you as a Welsh novelist and poet. Were you in fact born in Wales?
I was in fact born in Wales, yeah, in Swansea. Although my family's not Welsh. My mother is Scottish, my dad is English. So I'm Welsh by birth only.
And why? Why did you end up there? How did you end up there?
I ended up there because my dad got a job there. They're both academics, my parents, and my mum teaches art history. He teaches history. And there was some sort of deal done where he got a job, and I think my mother just kind of went with it. And then how many years? 50 years later, they're still there.
And people in Wales are usually very, very proud of where they come from. There's a big kind of quite a sort of nationalist feel behind being Welsh. Mm. Being Welsh born but not bred, is that the case for you?
It is the case, but maybe not with the true Welsh dragon fire of someone who came from the valleys and has the, I guess, the full family and language. Like, you do feel a bit of a cheat not speaking the language. I mean, you know, I'm not alone. There are millions of Welsh people who don't speak Welsh, but maybe even the Welshest Welshman sometimes feels they're not Welsh enough.
Yeah. Now, writing, and your very first writing, because I understand it was computer games that really drew you into it.
Yeah, that's. I hope there's still something like this, but there was this program on my first computer that allowed you to create your own computer games. And, you know, like, the amount of work involved was not that different from a novel. It was a huge amount of work. You'd create all the sprites, and then you'd create the levels, and then you'd create, you know, a little narrative. And I tended to write about, create games about things that were going on in my life. So, like, there was some depression in my family. So, like, the first game I wrote was called Depression, inventively. And it was, like, about this guy who's trying to work out ways to kill himself. Which sounds like I was a really bleak child. I wasn't. I was a really cheerful child, but whatever. I thought it was funny. And then another game was about joyriding, because Swansea was the car crime capital of Europe at that time. And we lived by this really impressive cobbled steep hill, which seemed to be the highlight of any joyriding. So you could hear the cars screeching down. So I made two Joyrider games, a sequel, popular sequel.
Joyrider 2.
Joyrider 2, according to my friend John, the better version.
So how did you sort of mutate from that into straight storytelling without the graphics?
I don't know. I wrote some comics as well, which I guess was a step along that path. And then at school, there was so little creative writing that I just remember when it came, I was just like, oh, this thing, it felt like such a relief. I kind of noted the fact that how excited I got about these little glimpses of. Sometimes we did poetry, sometimes we did stories, but maybe like three or four times in the entire school career, they really stayed with me. So I guess it was pretty clear that I was into it.
And so at what point did you think, actually, I could just be a writer? This is what my job's going to be.
Yeah, I think that was much, much later. I certainly didn't think that even going to university to study English literature and creative writing, which I did at UEA, I still thought... certainly not a career here. It didn't seem realistic. I didn't know any writers, and it wasn't a path that I knew how to get to. And then slowly over my university career, which went straight on to an MA also in creative writing, I guess the great thing about UEA is it does make that seem feasible. You have people who've been to that university and have gone on to be writers. So by the end, you're starting to think, okay, actually this is feasible.
And your writing career plays back into your childhood, because of course Submarine, your first book, is all about a young boy growing up in very similar circumstances to yours.
Yeah, completely. It's the classic first novel autobiographical thing. And when I started writing that, I just thought I was writing short stories. In fact, I had tried and failed to write novels previous to that, and so I was just kind of settled down writing short stories. And I started writing about this character Oliver, who's a 15-year-old Swansea boy, and it kind of came naturally. I was having a lot of fun, and I didn't, because I'd failed at novels before, I had to kind of pretend I wasn't writing a novel for as long as I possibly could. So I was saying, I'm writing short stories, until I had like 40,000 words, and it's like, maybe this isn't mm-hmm. short stories. But yeah, it was just great to have Swansea as my feeding ground, basically, because it was all in there. I guess everyone has that about the place they grew up in. Just felt so rich and textured. And also, there aren't that many Swansea novels. There really are hardly any. So it felt like a good place to start.
So in many ways, what you've achieved is a dream come true for a debut novelist, because here was Submarine, fantastically successful as a book, and then gets not only bought, optioned as a film, but actually made, which the difference between the two is huge.
Is huge, yeah, and completely unlikely, and I'm still amazed by that, because, you know, just even if you get optioned, everyone says, don't expect anything, it'll never happen, you're dreaming, so just forget about it. And so I did kind of have the attitude. I thought, well, it's great, it's option. But then they made it within 18 months of the option. They just made it so quickly and so well with great, passionate people. And it was a total dream. It was amazing.
Mm. Well, should we just hear a clip from the film?
Most people think of themselves as individuals, that there's no one on the planet like them. This thought motivates them to get out of bed, eat food, and walk around like nothing's wrong. My name is Oliver Tate. I suppose it's a bit of an affectation, but I often wish there was a film crew following my every move. So I'm in a documentary about a prominent thinker who struggled with unspeakable loss. I've tried smoking a pipe, flipping coins, I've even had a brief art phase, but nothing stuck.
So how did that happen so fast? Because it is unusual.
Yeah, well, they sent it to Richard Ayoade, the director. The weird thing was that my friend Ali, who works at Warp Films, the production company, he had read my novel before it was even published. So he'd read it in manuscript. I think he'd even given it to his boss in manuscript. So actually, like, the film company were already excited about it before it even came out in hardback. So there was a kind of parallel thing going on where the film was starting to move even as the book came out. So it gave it a sense of the film having followed really quickly on the book's tail. But anyway, yeah, Richard liked the novel, and we met, and I liked him, and we started talking about it. And then he went away and wrote the script, well, with me as a script consultant. And then it just, in a way that seems kind of unimaginable now, it all just fell into place.
As a consultant, how involved does that mean you are?
Well, that means that we talked a lot about what we wanted the film to be and what we thought the story was. Richard took me into his attic and we watched a load of films that I guess had a relationship to what we hoped it might be. Like, I don't know, we watched like Harold and Maude, and we also watched, because we knew the film would have voiceover, we watched a lot of films that used voiceover really well, and as is the case with lots of films, use it really badly, to see what could go wrong, which was really fascinating. You know, watched Woody Allen and we watched Scorsese and we watched, what was for voiceover? I think we watched American Psycho to look at maybe how voiceover can be bad. And then when he started writing the script, he sent me the drafts as he went along, and I got to kind of put my oar in every now and then.
Because that whole page to screen transition isn't always successful. I know you've written about that.
Yeah, exactly. And weirdly, I don't know if it's a generational thing, but there's a load of writers, older writers, who are kind of moany about their film adaptations, as if, I don't know, for me it just seems like a miracle that it happens at all. But, you know, like John le Carré's got this famous quote, seeing your book turned into a film is like seeing your field of oxen turned into bouillon cubes. And then Stephen King moans about Kubrick's The Shining, which is the most absurd thing to complain about. And then he remade The Shining himself as this really terrible TV series that was a disaster. So I don't know, it's just, there are a lot of bad book-to-film adaptations, and there's a lot of good ones which the writers still don't see as good.
You were talking about sort of tricking yourself into writing Submarine, in that you were sort of writing a series of short stories. And I wonder a couple of things. First, how do you know that a novel has failed, that it's time just to walk away from it?
Yeah, that's such an impossible question. I think it often haunts you, even when a book is going well, or, you know, you can have a problem and suddenly think, oh, this might be the time to dump it, because what if it's like 3 years later and I'm still going and then I dump it? I don't know. It's a really weird one. And I've dumped a few novels, normally around the 15, 20,000 word mark. My biggest fear is to get to 100,000 words and then stop. And I have friends who done that with like a 4 or 5 year novel and then been like, no, it's not working. And that terrifies me. I think all writers have that, the thought of, you know, am I wasting my life here?
And so can you take bits of those abandoned novels and put them together, perhaps in short story form, to build your successful, your ultimately successful novel?
Yeah, there is a kind of strip mining thing. I find this with poetry as well. I think you can feel better about your failures if you have a sense, maybe a slightly deluded sense, that you're going to recycle. So I do have this recycle folder on my computer where I strip out good character descriptions, good metaphors, interesting ideas from failed projects in the hope that they will get reused eventually. And sometimes they do, especially given that I write in a few different genres. I can often take an image that was in a short story or in a failed novel and find a home for it in a poem, if I'm lucky.
Well, I know that famously you don't plan a structure of the whole book before you start.
No, I don't. I think writers tend to be split into planners and non-planners. I'm of the school that wants to feel excited about the page ahead of me every morning and not know and have the sense, however deluded, that I could go anywhere and do anything and take my story in whatever direction, even if probably there's in my subconscious quite a stable shape to a story or certainly an ending I want to get to. But as soon as I see a plan on paper, it does kill a bit of me that's excited.
Your second book, Wild Abandon, I mean, that's always a very difficult thing to do, to have a hit with your second book, which it's not only a hit, it's a prize winner. That was based on something real.
Yeah, that was inspired by a friend of mine at university called Martha, who we didn't know what her upbringing was. I guess you don't know what all your friends' upbringings are, but she was seen particularly coy. And then one day we learnt that her middle name was Acorn. And that seemed an unusual decision. And then we kind of prodded her and discovered she'd grown up on this very amazing commune in South Wales. She's not far from where I grew up. And I went to visit her family there. It's an amazing place, still going, which is unusual for most communes. It's been going since the early 80s. So it's very long running and quite successful. It's changed a lot over the years. And her parents set it up. They were Oxbridge graduates. Oh, I think they were at Oxford, and they just left and went to start a community with a few of their friends. Found this cottage in Pembrokeshire, did up over a number of years. They had, you know, the big house, and they had outhouses, they had a geodesic dome, and it really worked for a certain amount of time. Families came in, children were born. It was the kind of the ideal for communal success, and they always measure the success of a commune by how many children are there, and they had lots of children being homeschooled. And then going on to go to university and all these things. So it was great. But her parents at some point broke up. And in the novel, I play it. And I mean, I don't know the details of their family to say this is from her. But in my novel, I play it along ideological grounds. The parents, the father, rather the mother believes that the community is not hardline enough on ethical and self-sufficiency grounds. And the father is more easygoing, and they kind of tear the community in two based along those boundaries with their children in between.
It's a really funny book, though, too, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That was an interesting thing writing about communes, is that there are easy gags, I guess, about hippies and sex and free love and these sorts of things, which are tempting. And I tried to walk a line where I'm still willing to obviously have fun with my characters and put jokes in, but try and avoid the kind of cheap gags about dropouts or about, I don't know. In my experience of visiting communes, communal life had moved on from any of the 60s cliches. So I tried to kind of find that while still being willing to mock my characters.
And of course, the characters talking about this whole very real thing of it being a fascinating institution that people want to have a look at. I mean, they're constantly fending off reality television producers.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And being a novelist going into to your research, just that question of like, should I admit that I'm one of them? I'm coming in to try and write something about these communities. Yeah, like radio, like the other day, it's not Bear Grylls, but another posh outdoorsy man went to visit my friend Martha's mother in her adobe hut in the woods and spent a week there living without electricity and things. You know, so there's often these TV shows and producers coming to try and experience real self-sufficient life.
There's one scene in the book that I particularly like, where the father says life is about amplifying good information and ignoring the bad. And that's all about the Soviet hat. Tell us about the Soviet hat.
The Soviet hat does exist. I saw it at an exhibition in maybe the V&A, I can't remember. It's basically a device that an artist made where you put headphones on and you wear a hat that has a directional microphone. The idea is that you can kind of, whatever you look at is what you hear, and you can control more of the world around you rather than just receiving all this bad data. Your ears are so kind of open and unfocused. It allows your ears to be like your eyes, and you can decide much more narrowly on what you want to see in the world and hear in the world.
No, it's a fascinating premise, and from that comes a lot of what's in the book, actually.
Yes, exactly. I guess that's the idea of positioning yourself if you're going to move into the woods, into the countryside, or, you know, away from other societies. You're making this decision about what you want to experience. They have in the community in my book, they have this thing called the Adguard, which is a bit of shower curtain that the dad has cut up and attached to the TV so that when the adverts come on, you pull the Adguard across and you have to mute the TV in order to not take in the adverts. And, you know, this is just a sense of kind of trying to turn the world into the best version of itself through deliberate means.
We haven't talked about poetry at all. And of course, you're one of Faber's young poets. And I wonder about the whole moving between genres and how easy that is for you.
Poetry's always been a kind of baseline for me. I always go back to it, and it's probably the most automatic part of my writing practice. And whatever I'm doing, if there's a pause between things, I'm always back to poetry. And in terms of its relationship to my other work, it's interesting. I think it's really useful, especially as a novelist, to have ways of solving a problem or solving a scene that aren't narrative necessarily. And poetry gives you a kind of armory of moves, imagery, sound, rhythm, whatever that allows you. I do think of it sometimes a bit like in a musical when the writer wants the character to change their mind about something, so they're supposed to be going on a journey, but for whatever reason they don't want to go on the journey. And then there's a song, and at the end of the song, they change their mind and they go on the journey. And I sometimes feel like that with poetry, in that if I'm writing a novel, you can kind of cheat and press the poetry button, go nuclear, and then by the end of some passage, hopefully, the reader believes that something magical has happened, the epiphany has happened, and your character has changed. That makes it sound really cynical, but I think it can work in an authentic way.
Your poems seem to have the same kind of gentle humour that your novels contain, and I wondered if we might hear one of them. I was thinking in particular about A Sestina for My Friends.
Yes, you can certainly hear that. I'm sure your listeners know what A Sestina is, but it's a poem that has six repeating end words. It's supposed to sound conversational despite that form. It's called Sestina for My Friends. I know what my friends think because of the things they say. Joe, you are shiny and worthwhile and always thinking of others. I am not so great. I could name at least five people who are better overall. Here's one of my faults. I'm forever calculating how to present myself in any given situation. Calculating people give W.G. Sebald's Rings of Saturn as a gift and think that the person receiving the book will think better of them. After reading it, they will say, Joe, it was beautiful. I mean, he's like the great Gramps I never had. He even made Suffolk compelling. I always give Rings of Saturn as a gift, sometimes even to boys. Always is too much. I have given it twice, if I'm calculating honestly. Once to a girl who thought I was great for just over a month until she suspected, correctly, that I think I am more interesting than her. If I say that the boy I gave it to was far better at football than me, then I think you understand. Better to be left for dead on the right wing, always knowing that the boy who embarrassed you, let's say his name is Luke, has this book in his bedroom. I'm calculating that he won't have sold it because he thinks, nay, hopes that one day he might read it. This great and clever book that was a gift from a friend who's not great at football, but by God, he's got a brain, and ultimately, it's better to have enormous thoughts than to be almost semi-pro. I think great people don't have these kinds of thoughts. I always keep my mauled copy somewhere half inconspicuous, calculating the spot where guests will see it, sure, but they will not say, I bet Joe put that there so I see it. More likely they'll say, huh, such a clever book, just lying there next to his football boots. It's great to know someone like Joe who's clever but doesn't rub your face in it. Calculating people are some of the worst in existence. This poem is better for its honesty. Even when I admit this stuff, my friends can always fall back on my honesty. He thinks too much, they think. We'd best not say anything about that Sestina. He'll always be great to us. Better than great, more like excellent. Or this is what I'm calculating.
It's a wonderful poem. And it's a nod, too, to your love of football.
It is.
Now, tell us about the writers' football team, the England writers' football team, rather grandly named.
The England writers' football team is one of the writers' football teams in the world. There are probably 10 now. There's a Scottish, Italian, Swedish, Norwegian, German. And it began with Alessandro Barrico in Italy, the writer of that great novel Silk, who I think it'd be fair to say the idea of the league was to try and reposition the kind of high-minded idea of the Writers' League is to reposition the idea of the writer as not writerly, but as Hemingway-ish and strong and something that boys could get into. In reality, we are not Hemingway-ish, we're rubbish, but we do play regularly and occasionally we have international games. We play Scotland every year, it's really fun. We either go up to Glasgow or they come down here to London and it's just an amazing thing. You know, get to meet lots of writers from different places. We have readings. We sometimes read poems about football, but often we just read whatever. Yeah, it's wonderful.
It sounds such fun and such a move away from the ivory tower.
Yeah, completely. Like. Yeah.
Now, Choose Your Own Adventure is another work that I've seen only online. Tell me about that.
Well, that comes back to the computer games thing. I guess I'm still carrying on my love of computer games, even though I don't have that much time to play them anymore. And the Choose Your Own Adventure form, it's originally a book, a type of book, as I'm sure people know, but then also I was thinking of text adventure computer games where you normally start, it'll be like you're in a dark room and you kind of have to type, look around or go east or go west or whatever. And so I had that in my mind when I wrote this story. And it's only on my website, but it's trying to update that because it used to be a Dungeons and Dragons type thing, you know. Do you want to stab the troll in the thigh or run between its legs? But this is set on a middle-class picnic, so it's like a do you want to have the black olive or the green olive? And your life forks off in two directions depending which way you go.
What fun to put together. You have to think of every possible permutation then.
Yes, it's great. I've got this fat, even though it's a short story, maybe 10 minutes to read, I've got this fat book of options.
Yeah. You've also done a map book, Where You Are, or been a contributor to it.
Yeah, that was a great project by Visual Editions, a really nice London publisher. And they got a whole group of writers and artists to make maps. They didn't have to be maps. They could be maps of places someone hadn't been. Jeff Dyer did a map of his places in Cheltenham where he had key childhood experiences. And I did a map of my inner literary landscape, I guess, of my writerly influences, distractions, problems, writers I love, writers I hate, whatever it is, but in a kind of pirate's treasure map type form.
It's very funny. I loved it. I would urge people to have a look at it. So that's on your website, which is just, what, joedunthorne.com.
Yeah.
Right. Well, finally, tell us what's coming next, because there are a couple of really exciting things.
Yes. What's coming next? Well, I've just got the publishing date for my new novel, which is called The Adulterance, and comes out February 2018, which is quite a long time away, but good to start trailing it.
Well, why so far ahead?
Because, well, a year is a normal publishing distance, but they don't like to publish authors who aren't super famous in the run-up to Christmas, unless you're Jamie Oliver or Zadie Smith. They tend to think you'll get lost under the superbooks in Christmas time. So basically, I just missed the boat a little bit. So they're pushing it into 2018, which I don't mind because I'm enjoying having saying the sentence, my book is going to come out, and I'll get to say it for longer now.
And knowing you've written it, there's no pressure. It's
exactly,
done.
Yeah. I would, in many ways, like to extend this, if I could just know that it was coming out in 2025 and just have a decade off. Yeah. And yeah, I'm just doing other things, like working on a film script and working on a TV thing. And yeah, so just other, and poetry obviously is ongoing, and hopefully I'll have a poetry collection before too long.
Well, so that new book coming out, we've got to wait until February 2018. However, Wild Abandon and Submarine, published out now and available at all good bookstores, as they say. Joe Dunthorne, thank you so much for coming on to Meet the Writers.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. My thanks to producer Claire Urban and researcher Maria Grignana. Thank you for joining us.